From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As the White House prepares to send 100,000 more troops to the Persian Gulf, House Republicans have slashed $15 billion in veterans benefits. We'll have a debate on the new budget. Now in Washington, thousands have gathered outside the Supreme Court, set to hear arguments today on affirmative action. And we'll look at the history of fragging, when soldiers kill their superiors. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. troops shot and killed at least seven Iraqi civilians yesterday, including women and young children, at an intersection near Karbala. Officers from the Army's 3rd Infantry Division say a van packed with 15 civilians approached the intersection. The Washington Post reports Captain Ronnie Johnson repeatedly ordered his troops to fire warning shots. When they failed to take action, he yelled at them to stop the van. The troops responded by firing several high-explosive rounds into the passenger cabin of the van. According to the Washington Post, 10 people, including women and 5 children, who appeared to be under 5 years old, were killed on the spot. 26-year-old Army medic Sergeant Mario Manzano said, quote, "It was the most horrible thing I've ever seen, and I hope I never see it again." He said one of the wounded women sat in the vehicle holding the mangled bodies of 2 of her children. He said she didn't want to get out of the car. Hours later, U.S. Marines killed another Iraqi civilian at another roadblock. The Pentagon issued a statement contradicting the Washington Post's account. The Pentagon claims troops fired on the van after the driver ignored shouted orders and warning shots, and the Pentagon says 7 people were killed, not 10. The tragedy comes after 4 U.S. Marines were killed by a suicide bomber at a nearby checkpoint on Saturday. After the bombing, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Rudder told the New York Times that Iraqis who now approach the checkpoint have 5 seconds to turn around or, quote, "they're dead." Civilians in Janabaya, a village on the southeastern edge of Baghdad, said coalition forces bombed the town earlier this week, killing 20 people, including 11 children and 7 women. A journalist with the Agence France-Presse visited the area and reported bloodied school books and children's shoes lying amidst animal carcasses on the road. One of the 2 survivors from the house that was hit said, quote, "5 children were turned into human torches in this house because of the gas cylinders inside." A neighbor with missile debris in his hands said, quote, "That is Bush's democracy. They want us to welcome them with flowers. Look what they've done to our families." AFP journalists have witnessed 5 incidents in which civilians were the primary victims of a coalition strike. They've reported at least 70 dead and dozens wounded. In other incidents barely mentioned by the U.S. media, Mark Franchetti of the Sunday Times in Britain reported finding 12 dead civilians lying in the road or in nearby ditches in Nasiriya. A girl aged no more than 5 lay dead in a ditch beside the body of a man who may have been her father. One man's body was still on fire. A father, baby girl, and boy had been buried in a shallow grave. Franchetti reported the civilians had been trying to leave the town, probably for fear of being killed by U.S. helicopter attacks or heavy artillery. He wrote, quote, "Their mistake had been to flee over a bridge that is crucial to the coalition supply lines and to run into a group of shell-shocked young American Marines with orders to shoot anything that moved." A surgical assistant at the Saddam Hospital in Nasiriya told the London Guardian that U.S. aircraft had dropped 3 or 4 cluster bombs on civilian areas in the city, killing 10, wounding 200. The Guardian also reports correspondents have seen more than a dozen burnt-out buses and trucks and the bodies of at least 60 Iraqi men on the road north of Nasiriya. A British officer said U.S. Marines who were escorting him through the port of Umm Qasr let loose a volley of rifle fire at a house on the outskirts of town. He told Reuters they said they had been shot at from the house a few days ago, so they were giving them a warning. The British officer said, quote, "That is something we would never condone." A U.S. Special Forces officer told Reuters it's sometimes difficult to contain the exuberance of men doing the actual fighting. Meanwhile, U.S. peace activists have provided the first confirmation that the hospital in the western town of Rutba has been destroyed by bombs. The Associated Press is reporting that as the Iraq peace team members approached, a doctor demanded, why did you Americans bomb our children's hospital? The activists said they saw no significant Iraqi military presence near the hospital or elsewhere in Rutba. U.S. Central Command claimed Sunday it has no knowledge of the incident. The first U.S. conscientious objector from the invasion of Iraq will give himself up at a Marine base in California this morning. 20-year-old reservist Stephen Eagle Funk says he believes the war is, quote, immoral because of the deception involved by our leaders. Funk faces a possible court-martial and time in military prison for his action. U.S. soldiers preparing to march to Baghdad are fighting at close range with members of Iraq's Republican Guard for the first time. U.S. officers said 200 Iraqis had been killed, wounded, or captured in the first major battle against units of the elite Iraqi Guard that broke out overnight southeast of Karbala, 50 miles from Baghdad. Meanwhile, the extremely intense bombing of Baghdad is continuing around the clock. The AFP is reporting at least 7 of Baghdad's telephone exchanges have been pounded in recent days, knocking out services in some areas and adding to the anguish of residents. Intense fighting is underway near the Tomb of Ali in the town of Najaf, where more than 1,000 Fedayeen fighters have reportedly taken cover. The walled shrine marks the resting place of the Prophet Muhammad's son-in-law and is one of the holiest sites for Shiite Muslims. One U.S. soldier was killed in the fighting, and U.S. warplanes bombed targets as close as half a mile from the shrine. The Iraqi information minister, Saeed al-Shaaf, says U.S. warplanes have bombed two buses carrying international volunteers, including some Americans. An anonymous senior official from the U.S. Central Command in Qatar told reporters yesterday the U.S. is prepared to pay a, quote, very high price in terms of casualties in order to capture Baghdad and oust Saddam Hussein. Referring to World War II, when U.S. forces lost 1,000 people some nights, he added, quote, there will come a time maybe when things are going to be much more shocking. Also yesterday in Doha, the Pentagon showed video of U.S. bombs destroying Iraqi aircraft as part of its daily briefing. But British military analyst Paul Beaver told the BBC that the Iraqi aircraft sitting out in the open on the runways look like useless decades-old decoys. The former publisher of Jane's Defense Weekly said he was surprised they would put the video on TV. U.S. intelligence and military officials say they're scaling back a three-month effort to persuade Iraq's generals and Ba'ath Party leaders to surrender and oust Saddam Hussein after it failed to produce any significant defections. A senior intelligence official told USA Today, quote, we misjudged their tenacity. Meanwhile, the British newspaper The Daily Mirror has hired veteran Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent Peter Arnett. Arnett was fired by NBC yesterday for telling the Iraqi state television that the U.S. war plan had failed due to Iraqi resistance. Arnett told The Mirror, quote, I am still in shock and awe at being fired. He said, I report the truth of what is happening here in Baghdad and will not apologize for it. Arnett is one of the last U.S. correspondents left in Baghdad. And the London Observer is reporting the retired U.S. general who will oversee humanitarian relief and construction in post-war Iraq is also the president of an arms company that provides crucial technical support to missile systems vital to U.S. invasion of Iraq. Jay Garner is president of the Virginia-based Cy Coleman, a subsidiary of Defense Electronics Group L3 Communications. L3 Communications provides technical services and advice on the Patriot missile system being used in Iraq. The issue is causing serious concerns at the United Nations and among aid agencies who say appointment of an American link to the arms trade is the worst-case scenario for running the country after the invasion.
Make the sign of peace and sing now. Stop the war.
Stop the War. Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now! As we turn right away to the Supreme Court, where thousands of students have gathered from across the country to protest outside as the Supreme Court is set to hear arguments in the University of Michigan affirmative action cases. Students from more than 200 colleges and universities are at the pro-affirmative action rally organized by Howard University students. More than six dozen buses have come from Detroit and Ann Arbor alone. It's expected to be one of the largest civil rights rallies since the 60s, and the case before the court is one of the most watched and most hyped cases in recent history. We're joined on the phone now by Andrea Van Dorn. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andrea.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. Please excuse my hoarse voice. We've been out here all night.
And can you talk about why you're there?
We're here because we want to show Sandra Day O'Connor that, one, she is a product of affirmative action, and two, that we are here and that we're not apathetic, that we come, African-Americans and minorities all over, Latinos, to show that we're in support of affirmative action, and that we are empathetic, and that we know that this case is going to determine the way that our children will go to higher education.
And can you talk about the students who are there, where they're from?
Wow, we have students from all over. I have students from UC Davis. I have students from UC Berkeley, Xavier, of course, Howard University, Hampton University, University of West Virginia. We have Tennessee State here. We have students from pretty much all over the country, from Oklahoma out in Langston. We have students pretty much all over the country here, united for a common cause. When we marched last night, we had approximately 5,000 students here who spent the night here at the Supreme Court in this blistering cold weather.
And what are your plans now, to stay through the day?
Actually, we're in line to get in the court, and we are the first online. So we're in the three-minute line, and what they'll be doing is doing rotation in intervals of 3 minutes. That allows our faces to be seen by Sandra Day O'Connor, since our voices can't be heard. So we'll be putting our face right there in the courtroom, allowing her to see us, and just allowing her to understand that just as she came from affirmative action, that we too depend on affirmative action, and that she has a responsibility to us.
And can you summarize the case that is before the Supreme Court, Andrea Van Dorn?
Sure. Pretty much right now, there are two cases going on, one called Gratz v. Bollinger, and the other one is a law school case which are going on, both where students felt that they were unjustly denied access into the University of Michigan because of race. And what pretty much is being said here is that race is a major factor in how we can make the students and the universities diverse. If we were to take affirmative action away, we would be just like the state of California, where they have, in, for example, UC Berkeley, a school of 30,000, only 75 African Americans and 3.9% minorities on the whole. And California is just the beginning of what will happen throughout our country if we do not come here and stand up for what is going on. We are here in support of Brown versus Board of Ed. We are here so that next year we will be commemorating 50 years, not memorializing it.
Well, Andrea Van Dorn, thank you very much for being with us, Howard student organizer, and we are going to continue to look at this case tomorrow and review the questions and the arguments that are made in the Supreme Court today. Thank you, and get good luck in getting into the Supreme Court today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good day.
You are listening to Democracy Now! This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Jeremy Scahill, who has recently returned from Baghdad. Jeremy, a review of the recent news we're getting out of Iraq.
Well, we've heard of very heavy bombing over the last 24 to 48 hours, some of the heaviest to date in this almost 2 weeks of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. We understand that the University of Baghdad may have been hit today. That's a very crowded area of the city, and that would be very disturbing if it did happen. Also hearing these reports from the Iraqi Minister of Information that Iraq is alleging that two buses carrying international volunteers or human shields, including some Americans, has been hit. But, of course, we have no confirmation of that. Also, apparently, the training of Iraqi exiles in Hungary has come to an end, and the U.S. is denying that it's because they didn't have enough volunteers to participate in it. And now yesterday we heard at the Pentagon press briefings they've started using this phrase, free Iraqi forces, as though they have a Northern Alliance-type force. But in reality, they only have, admittedly, only 50 to 70 Iraqis that have actually agreed to participate on the ground with the United States.
Well, we're going to turn now to, speaking of forces, to U.S. forces. We have been talking about the forces on the ground in Iraq. What about the veterans here at home? The vote got little attention. The date was March 20th. The invasion of Iraq had just begun, so you might have missed what happened that day in Congress. On a near strict party line, the House of Representatives passed a draft budget for next year. Contained in it are $1.4 trillion in tax cuts, and it's caused a quiet storm of controversy, especially among veterans groups, which charge that the Republican leadership is cutting the Veterans Affairs budget by $15 billion. On the floor of Congress, Democratic Congressmember Edward Markey of Massachusetts said, "Last night, President Bush officially created a whole new group of 250,000 war veterans, yet he does not even have enough money in his budget to take care of this country's obligations to veterans of the first Persian Gulf War, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, or World War II. He said never before has a president cut taxes in the face of war. According to New York Times, the Civil War gave birth to an estate tax, and World War II expanded the income tax. But during the war in Iraq, the Bush administration plans to cut taxes by a total of nearly $2 trillion over the next 10 years. Congressmember Markey went on to say, "This tax cut for the rich is a fiscal MOAB, mother of all bombs, pointed right at the heart of the federal budget." Meanwhile, the House Republican leadership countered that Veterans Affairs will not see a budget cut, but an increase of $4 billion next year. Well, right now we're going to have a debate on this issue, on the status of veterans' benefits under the new proposed budget. We're joined by Susan Edgerton, who is Democratic Staff Director of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and Congressman Scott Garrett, Republican of New Jersey. Congressman Scott Garrett, has the Republican leadership cut the veterans' benefits?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for the opportunity to be with you. And what the Republicans have, in essence, been doing year in, year out, as far as the veterans' benefits, and benefits is not the correct term, the budget for the veterans, ever since the Republicans took control, has been to increase the amount of money that we spend. So, therefore, you look at the numbers from the beginning when the Republicans took control of the House, a few years back until where we are today, there has gone up around a little over 6% per year, in a figure that's greater, obviously, than family income or cost of living increases every single year on average, from $42 billion up to $57 billion where we are today. So we've seen a continuous increase, or if you charted it out, and if you're looking on a graph right now, you would see a line going up to your right, upwards, every single year that the Republicans have been in office.
Susan Edgerton, Democratic Staff Director of House Veterans Affairs Committee, going up the benefits?
Technically, he is right about the budget is going up. It's just, is it going up enough to meet current service level needs for the veterans? He's talking about a budget that the president has put forward, and that's the budget that was supported in the budget resolution, which contains $1.1 billion of savings that VA is supposed to find out of current services for the next fiscal year. And he's also talking about a budget that's based on a lot of assumptions about legislative proposals that are going to be passed by this Congress, which I don't think Congress has a great taste for, like raising co-payments for certain veterans and putting in an enrollment fee.
Well, what about the charge that the Veterans Affairs budget has been slashed by $15 billion?
There are cuts in the president's budget proposed by the House for mandatory programs, which include programs that pay benefits to veterans, disabled veterans. That's a cash benefit program that compensates veterans for war injuries and other injuries that are incurred during service, military service.
If I may just chime in on just to address one of your one of the points you make. The argument that is made, and it was made on the floor during the debate of the entire budget when it passed the House, that trying to define in Washington speak what a cut is, I find as a freshman congressman and someone coming down here from the business world, is somewhat of an intriguing or maybe amusing, might be too flippant a word for it. You know, in any other field of business or your life, if you had $10, getting $10 today, and you thought you were going to get $12 next year, but instead your boss said, we're not going to pay you $12 next year, we're going to pay you $11. Well, in Washington, that's considered a cut. To me, going from $10 to $11 would still be an increase. But down here, because you're not getting as much as you anticipated you were going to get, the argument is always say, well, now we're going to be cutting that program because we're not getting as much as we thought we were going to be getting. And we have to turn that around. That's just maybe doesn't go particularly to the point we're making here, but you did, the other person here, I'm sorry, Susan, is it, raise that argument. I think we have to agree on the terms, and a cut is actually when you're starting at $10 and you're going to go down from that figure, not if you're going to be going up.
Okay. Mr. Garrett, I can tell you that what I'm referring to is a decrease in the amount that the president's budget proposed. And that's just a matter of record.
Right.
The budget proposal does decrease the amount the president would have spent over this next 10-year period. And those are real cuts that this committee, the VA committee, is going to have to find ways to cut veterans' benefits if this is proposed, if this is passed as proposed. It will result in what they call budget reconciliation instructions, which are sent to the committee, and we'll have to find ways to cut benefits for veterans.
Susan Edgerton of the Democratic Staff Director of the House Veterans Affairs Committee and Congressman Scott Garrett, we have to break for 60 seconds, and then we're going to be joined by Ashley Decker, sophomore at University of Pittsburgh, Johnstown, who wrote an article that was just published called Support the Warrior, Not the War, Give Them Their Benefits. Stay with us.
Sing a song of sad young men, glasses full of rye, all the news is bad again. Kiss your dreams goodbye. All the sad young men sitting in the bars, drinking up the nights and missing all. All the sad young men drifting through the town.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests on the line with us are Susan Edgerton, Democratic Staff Director, House Veterans Affairs Committee. We're joined by New Jersey Republican Congressmember Scott Garrett and Ashley Decker, sophomore at University of Pittsburgh in Johnstown. Can you talk about your piece that was published on Common Dreams, Support the Warrior, Not the War, Give Them Their Benefits? Your dad is a Vietnam vet?
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. 100% disabled?
Yes, he is.
So how is he affected by the legislation that is being proposed, or is he?
So far, he's not been affected. I primarily wrote the piece to address the veterans that will be coming back from this war. And then long term down the line, he may very well be affected. I don't know yet, but it's not a risk that I want to see being being undergone.
And I would join in there that I would say that there's not one member that I've spoken to from either side of the aisle, either in the budget committee or just in general when I'm on the floor of the House, that would say that we should be doing anything that would be affecting any of the veterans who are disabled, such as in your family, from the benefits that they're receiving, nor anyone that's coming back from overseas after this war that are coming back that are disabled. I've not heard a member from either side of the aisle saying that we should be doing anything that's going to impact negatively, to decrease their benefits or adversely impact us, and in fact impact them. So, and it's just not part of the discussion.
Susan Edgerton.
First of all, I want to thank Ashley for her article. I thought it was really compelling, and obviously it's our desire to do as much for veterans as we're able to do within the budget constraints. And I can tell you that the Committee on Veterans Affairs recommended a budget increase of $3 billion for this year's budget. So we would like to do a lot more for veterans, and especially, for veterans that are already among us and for future veterans.
And one thing that we're trying to do in this budget, and it's not simply in the areas of veterans, but it's in all aspects of the federal government, is to say that sometimes you can do more for a particular segment that needs those services by making sure that the services that we're providing now are being provided to them in the best ways possible. And I'll tell you this, and maybe Ashley can comment on it, is that although you have programs out there, I do hear from veterans from all ages that are getting benefits or are looking to get benefits, and they say, well, the services are pretty good, but this could be improved, or I can't believe that I had to wait in this line here, or this problem over here, or I had some difficulty with doctors in this particular area here. But generally it's good, but here are some problem areas. They bring them up to me, and now it's my job. Of course, on budget committee, we don't get into it per se, but in the Veterans Committee, it's going to be incumbent upon them to take a look at the programs and say, are we providing the services at the most efficient and the best way possible to make sure that your family's veterans get the services they need and the future veterans get them as well. And I think it's incumbent upon both sides of the aisle, again, to see, can't we be doing it a little bit better?
Yeah, I'd just like to comment
Sure. Just
for a moment. I think VA has done a lot to increase its efficiency in recent years. Since 1996, they've doubled their workload, and at the same time, they've taken about a 10% hit in their in the number of full-time employees they have. So we've already seen a great deal of increases in productivity from the staff that are remaining at the VA hospitals.
And
Ashley,
I'd
like to bring Ashley back into this conversation. Ashley Decker, if you can describe your own experience as the daughter of a Vietnam vet disabled, how his experience in the Vietnam War and his disabilities and your own have affected you, and what veterans benefits mean.
Absolutely. Growing up, at first, I didn't understand what was wrong with my father. I honestly, there were times I just thought he had a temper in him. There would be times growing up where he would be fine one minute, and the next minute, like, this rage that I didn't know where it came from would just come out. And it wasn't until I was about 15 that I even knew what post-traumatic stress disorder was. And it got to the point where my father just couldn't work anymore. He didn't know how to deal with the public. And he just shut down emotionally. And so when my mother was to the point where, because my mother's disabled as well, my mother was going to try to get some kind of assistance. And then it was only then that we found out that the veterans even had these kind of programs available to them. And once he started to get help, the change in him now, he's never going to be the man that he was before he went to the war. The war is always going to still be with him. And I don't know how many people realize how much it affects not just a veteran, but how much it affects the family. Growing up, there were times where my mother was just ready to take me and just leave because we didn't understand what was going on anymore.
And what about your physical disabilities?
It's never been, with Agent Orange, it's never been, they've never linked it, but there are case studies that seem to link a lot of the problems that I have to Agent Orange. I was born with severe digestive problems where I cannot digest food properly. As far as, like, I stopped growing in third grade. I'm 4'8". I'm 19 years old, and I'm 4'8". I started forming kidney stones at the age of 14. I have a little bit of spina bifida, but fortunately it's not full-blown, like many of the veterans' children seem to be born with.
And what did veterans' benefits mean in your house? How was your father and yourself, how were you helped?
It's been wonderful. My father, he gets 100% disability, so that, I think he deserves every bit of it. For me, to go to school, I get what's known as non-educational benefits, where I get a stipend each month to help me get books and to live on with. So it's been wonderful, because my father just can't work anymore. It's not because he's lazy or he doesn't want to. It's because he just emotionally he does not know how to deal with the public.
Ashley Decker's piece appears at commondreams.org. Congressman Garrett, I know you're going to have to leave, but I want to ask you a related health benefits question that has to do with soldiers now in the Persian Gulf. It was on the front page of Marketplace section of the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and it says, health care as war casualty, reservist families give up employer-paid insurance for coverage with big gaps, by Peter Landers. Douglas Diamond, a major in the South Carolina Army National Guard, expected to make sacrifices when he was called to active duty November 2001, he didn't expect one of them to be medical care for his daughter. A local doctor wouldn't treat Mr. Diamond's daughter when she needed a colonoscopy because her insurance came from TRICARE, the Department of Defense entity serving members of the military. He said, here I am on active duty protecting my country and my daughter can't get treatment, said Mr. Diamond, who's since returned to a civilian job running the information systems at Anderson College in South Carolina. His plight illustrates a growing problem for the military healthcare system. As the U.S. calls up some 217,000 troops in the National Guard and reserves for active duty, while the law guarantees guardsmen and reservists their jobs, it doesn't require employers to keep paying for health insurance. Families like the Diamonds, who lose insurance from employers, can use TRICARE, but that can mean delaying care or paying for it themselves at a time when their income is likely to be lower than usual. Your response, Congressman?
I didn't see that particular article, but I certainly know that is a problem. I've received phone calls already to our offices from families who are back here in the States that are beginning to go through similar problems like that on the health side. And, of course, they're also going through the problems on the more immediate, and that's loss of the job. Because, as you say, the law doesn't require that the pay continues. Now, on the one hand, you have some corporations that are great corporations. I was just up in Bergen County in New Jersey at UPS Corporation. They have about 1,000 of their employees who have been called up to active duty and then are overseas or elsewhere right now, and they're continuing providing full pay and all the benefits to their employees and also counseling as well for the family members back here. But I think that article is right that's probably in the minority as far as corporations are concerned. So there are, and I just saw this in reading, I guess, in the last couple of days, there are some pieces of legislation that are being drafted, I guess you might say, as we speak, to try to provide some sort of federal relief in this area. The relief is going to have to come from this end of the aisle, from this end as far as from the Treasury as opposed to the business community. In other words, we're not going to be able to put that requirement on the small businesses who cannot simply afford to pick up the tab for the employee who is no longer there. So there is some legislation.
Susan Egerton, we have 30 seconds left. Your comment.
Yeah, I would agree. We are going to have to look at some legislative relief there. And I think that, you know, we were with a group yesterday discussing some options in that regard.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Susan Edgerton is a Democratic staff director, House Veterans Affairs Committee, Congressmember Scott Garrett, Republican of New Jersey, and finally, Ashley Decker, sophomore, University of Pittsburgh, Johnstown. Thank you very much for being with us. As we turn now to an issue that is not getting much attention right now, it's fragging, a term that has seldom been heard in a generation. It means to wound or kill a fellow soldier by throwing a grenade or similar explosive at the victim. During the Vietnam War, there were hundreds of so-called fragging incidents. Last week, the term re-entered headlines when U.S. Army Sergeant Ahsan Haqbar was detained on charges that he threw grenades into tents where his colleagues slept, killing a captain instantly and injuring 15 other members of the 101st Airborne Division, one of whom later died. Fragging was also the subject of a column by one of our guests, Earl Afari Hutchinson. He wrote, "The alleged grenade attack by U.S. Army Sergeant Ahsan Haqbar on U.S. soldiers in Kuwait stirred disturbing memories of the murderous attacks by American soldiers on each other during the Vietnam War. There were reported 209 fragging incidents during that conflict. The targets of the attacks were mostly junior field officers, and the men who killed their officers were in many cases African American. They were pushed over the top by what they considered the brutal, racist, and dehumanizing actions of white officers. Their hatred was fed by resentment of being drafted and forced to fight in what they considered a racist, senseless war against oppressed colored people." The problem of fragging first leaped to public attention in the 1971 trial of Billy Dean Smith. Smith, like Haqbar, was an African-American accused of killing two white officers. Though he was actually acquitted, the trial quickly turned from a focus on Smith's personal guilt or innocence to larger questions of Army racism and the waging of an unjust war. We're going to turn first to Imam Abdul Karim Hassan, the imam of the Los Angeles Mosque, where U.S. soldier Ahsan Haqbar worshipped when he was a little boy and a teenager. I reached him last night and asked him to talk about the man who is now accused of the fragging attack in Kuwait.
Well, his family used to come to our center here, and there were five of them, and he was the oldest. So they used to come to the center. He was about 10, 11 years old when I first saw him.
Were you surprised to hear about these reports?
Yes, I was. I mean, I knew the boy as a kid, and his nature did not foretell that some incident like this would be in his future. I couldn't see it, and the people that knew him couldn't see it. He was quiet. He was almost withdrawn and a very studious person. And never got into any tussles. He was not athletic. He didn't play basketball and soccer and the other things that kids usually play. He was mostly contented in reading books. So what happened to him, if it is true, is a complete shock to me.
And recently his mother got in touch with you, is that right?
Yes.
And what did she say?
Well, she said she didn't believe that that his son was guilty or had done such a thing as that. Not the son that she sent out that enlisted in the Army. Not the son that she knew that went on into college and took a double major. Not the son that she knew that grew up in a household. She said she doesn't believe it. She said he would have to look her in her eyes and tell her that he did it in order for her to believe that.
Did his brother say that before Hassan left, he said he feared he would be discriminated against as a black Muslim?
Well, there has been a lot of that happening, you know. You know, we're African American people. We've been discriminated against most of our lives, so we know what that's all about. Simply because we're African American, not because we've done anything, but because of the color of our skin. That's strike one. Then strike Strike two is when we become a Muslim, and then the people hold you, hold that against you because becoming Muslim, like you've changed your nature and become something other than a person. So, you know, naturally, since the military is a microcosm society of the outside community, naturally entering it, you would expect that they would have the same problems in that little society that they have in the outer society. In the outer society, you know, it's difficult to even try to rent an apartment, not only because you have men, but especially if you're Muslim. You know, people just don't even want to do that for fear that you turn into some kind of monster or something, which is not true. They don't do that to Christians who go out and commit all these different crimes, so I don't know why they want to blame Muslims.
I'm looking at a piece in the Boston Globe where Hassan Akbar is quoted as allegedly yelling when he was being taken away, "You guys are coming into our countries and you're going to rape our women and kill our children."
Well, number one, that quote doesn't seem to be accurate. And number one, he's not Iraqi. And being a Muslim doesn't make all Muslim countries his country. And they have not, and the American soldiers had not raped anybody. So I don't see how that statement could be attributed to him. I don't think that that's a real statement from him. You know, there's no smoking gun here for this kid, for this boy. I don't know what his attitude was like after he entered the military. I don't know what his attitude was like there. I never saw him as a member of the military. But I do know this, that his, as a kid, his nature or his character did not tell me that he was military material. He was just not aggressive. He was just not the gung-ho type. He was more or less a nerd. So to even be in the military in the first place, for him, having so much going for himself as he had, having an engineering degree, I don't even understand that part.
The report that I'm reading says he had been told by his superiors he would not be accompanying his unit into battle for reasons the military would discuss only generally. Greg Heath, a public affairs officer at Fort Campbell, said he was having what some people might call an attitude problem.
Well, that could mean anything. That could mean that could be reactionary. And all superiors, a lot of superiors look at any counter remark as reactionary anyway, so I couldn't put much validity in that.
Has his family been able to speak with him?
No, not to my knowledge, no. He's still under, I guess, under the military rule, and the military decides who shall and who shall not. All they know is that he's in Germany. And to my knowledge, they have not been able to speak to him yet. See, I told her to go to the Red Cross and see if she can do like other people in Iraq is doing right now. The Red Cross is, has gone into hospitals. The Red Cross is going into other camps, and is going into the American camps, and have brought letters into the American camps, so that the Iraqi prisoners can hear from their loved ones. So it seemed to me like this man being an American, he should be accorded the same justice. He should be allowed to hear from his parents and to write a letter to his parents and receive a letter for his parents. Right now, his parents have not said that they have even talked with him. They don't even know who to get in contact with. I told them to call the Red Cross.
What is his mother saying right now? What is she going through?
Well, she doesn't know what to do. You know, his mother, you know, I got a call from her on Saturday. She was going to talk to the news media, but then I talked to her last Thursday. She was going to talk to the news media, but then she got a visit from the FBI, she says. And the FBI advised her not to talk to the news media. So I couldn't understand accepting advice like that when the news media represents part of our four freedoms, which is the freedom of the press. And if I think that her story should be out there through the press, because if she doesn't get her story out there, then people are going to make up stories. And you would not want people to make up stories about the nature and the character of your son. You would want to let them know what that nature and character of your son really is, especially as he grew into adulthood. So I didn't agree with that decision.
And what did the FBI tell her about why she shouldn't talk?
Well, she didn't tell me why. She just said they told her not to talk to the news media.
But they wouldn't let her talk to him either.
No, well, I don't know who's preventing her from talking to him, but clearly the system is not working in favor of this mother talking to her son.
Imam Abdul Karim Hassan, Imam at the Los Angeles Mosque, where the U.S. soldier Hassan Akbar worshipped. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak to a researcher on fragging on the steering committee of the Military Law Task Force of the National Lawyers Guild, and Earl Afari Hutchinson, author and columnist. Stay with us. Nawa music of Marrakesh. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Luke Hyken, who is in the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force. You've studied fragging extensively. Can you give us a brief history?
Well, I was at Fort Ord when working at a project called the Military Law Project when the Billy Dean Smith case came to that base. And that was really the only case that the United States tried to use as a showpiece for prosecuting somebody for a fragging. And, you know, fragging comes from the word fragmentation grenade, and it was a unique experience to Vietnam because by 1969 and 1970, in 69 there were 239 fraggings reported, in 70 there were 383 a year. Now, a military can't fight a war when its enlisted personnel are blowing up their commanding officers. And many people attribute the end of the ground war in Vietnam to the degree to which there were fraggings. And fraggings don't even include the numbers of times when officers were, you know, killed without any explanation while they were out in the jungle on search and destroy missions. So that I'm sure the military is absolutely freaked out at what's happening with this new case. I mean, the idea that within 4 days of going into Iraq, there's a fragging must just shake them to the foundation. You know, there's been many centuries of resistance and rebellion against war that a lot of soldiers have always participated in. But the nature of a fragging is kind of beyond the realm of what any military person would expect. I mean, it's not resisting or walking away or refusing to fight. It's literally turning on your command and helping the enemy. I mean, it's a rare and unique phenomena mostly in a nation that has got people in its military who sympathize with the other side more than they do with their command, and that's an intolerable situation for any military.
We are also joined by Earl Afari Hutchinson, who recently wrote the article "Army Fragging: Racial Tension Back in Spotlight." Earl, can you expand on the points that you made in your piece?
A couple of things that really stood out in this, even though Sergeant Akbar at this point in time is just an alleged fragging. We don't know exactly all the circumstances. We know what the military is telling us, he allegedly said. But we also know something else, that this is probably the tip of the iceberg. When you go back and look at the long history of African-American involvement in recent wars, and especially Vietnam, we have seen situations where many of the fraggings, if not a majority of them, did involve African-Americans and oftentimes officers that they were the targets of for a lot of different reasons, racial resentment, personal resentment, inequitable treatment, and the reality of the fact that the Army has always put this happy face on about how African-Americans are treated. But in reality, it's totally different, especially in terms of how African-Americans are allowed to go up through the ranks. There's a tremendous amount of discrimination, and there's certainly great barriers there, too. So it would not be a great leap to think that this happy face that the Army continues to put on, in fact, even more so today, this kind of a safe haven and an oasis of racial tolerance and religious tolerance and advancement and promotion and just a society that's separate and apart from the reality of America for African Americans, that Akbar would be seen as an aberration, which is essentially what the Department of Defense is saying. But I submit that it's probably the tip of the iceberg. We're not getting a lot of information from the military or whatever we get in terms of inter-religious and interracial relationships is simply filtered through the military's great censorship mill. So the suspicion is that underneath there are a lot of tensions that aren't reported, a lot of confrontations, conflicts, incidents between African-Americans and especially African-American Muslims and perhaps other Muslims, too, that are a growing number of the armed forces, certainly not as dramatic as throwing a grenade into a tent or the alleged throwing of a grenade into a tent, killing two officers or two other servicemen. But we know the conflicts are there, we know the tensions are there, and we know it's also being suppressed by the military.
I'm looking at a Boston Globe piece that says the sergeant's family believe he was frustrated because racism had blocked his military advancement. Akbar was a combat engineer who specialized in clearing landmines and supervised as many as 8 soldiers. Nonetheless, he'd been told by his superiors that he would not be accompanying his unit into battle for reasons the military would discuss only generally.
You know, there was a 1996 survey that was done on racial relations, and it particularly focused on African-American attitudes toward Army service. And one thing that stuck out, even though, once again, it put this great face on how African-Americans are treated, of course, Colin Powell has always brought up all the black generals and the black commandants and officers and so forth, and how many African-Americans are allowed to go into training, different types of training areas in the Army, and education and skills are being promoted and career advancement. It went on and on with that, and we heard a lot of that. But underneath all of that, it also pointed out something else, and this kind of struck home when I read some of the accounts about Akbar. The advancement, still, there's a huge barrier, there's a huge ceiling in how African Americans in the lower ranks are treated as opposed to those that are moved, allowed to go up into the upper ranks. There's a lot of discrimination that the military still doesn't want to face up to, although in this 1996 report, African-Americans, when they were asked, I mean those in the military said that the barriers are still very much there in terms of advancement. Also, they also pointed out something else, and I think we see this, the types of positions that African-Americans are in. It's one thing to say, you know, you're getting all these great education and skill training and so forth, but then when you look really close at the Army, where are they in the Army? What types of positions are they in? What kind of skills are they being trained for? You know, we see, in fact, in one of the divisions that was ambushed and captured, we saw a number of African Americans in positions, service positions, cooks, camp guards, truckers, welders, all of these kinds of things, support positions. But when you think about it, how much advancement, once they're out of the military with these kinds of skills, are they going to be able to apply in the larger society in terms of providing a good career and good jobs? Very little.
Luke Hyken, with us from National Lawyers Guild. What now does this soldier, does Ahsan Akbar face?
Well, you know, there's so much speculation here to attribute to Akbar the motivations for what why people responded as they did in Vietnam. I think is difficult at this point. I think there's no question that if he is in fact going to be tried by court-martial, he's probably ahead of the game. I mean, Bush has got these draconian star chamber courts where nobody knows what's going on in them. There are people who, as he's sort of smirking about, well, they won't be a problem to us anymore at one of his speeches about people who are disappearing as they do in other countries. So that if Akbar is in fact going to be tried before a court-martial, he'll have a military lawyer. He'll have a right to a civilian lawyer, which I assume his parents will assist him to have. And we'll find out what his motivations were. I mean, the one thing we do know is it's a fragging. I mean, throwing a fragmentation grenade into the barracks is a fragging. Now, why he did it, we don't know. And it might be that the military will end up deciding that there's mental health problems there that motivated this. I just don't know how to evaluate one case, especially, as your other speaker pointed out, when the entire news that we're getting from it is filtered through the Pentagon.
Could he be classified as an enemy combatant?
Well, I think anybody that George Bush decides to characterize that way can be these days.
Which is a completely new category.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the right to a trial traditionally. You know, many people in the military itself opposed the Patriot Act and opposed these secret tribunals because for good or bad in terms of command influence and however, in whatever ways that distorts the military justice system, in the abstract, the system is a fair one. And the breakdown doesn't come in because there's not good discovery rules or not good evidentiary rules or not fair cross-examination rights. It's a very fair system. And if Akbar can have that, he's ahead of the game given this government and its administration that does not want people in the public to see the kinds of explanations people give for rebelling against it.
Well, Luke Hyken of National Lawyers Guild, Erla Farah Hutchinson, Peace, Army Fragging, Racial Tension Back in Spotlight. I want to thank you both for being with us. You can see that piece, by the way, at thehutchinsonreport.com. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera. Special help from Noah Reibel and Elizabeth Press, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Our website is democracynow.com. .org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. You can get a copy of today's show by calling 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. There's far too many of you dying. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Whole families were killed in this blast. When we arrived on the scene on Friday night, just a few hours after it had happened, people were still crying and wailing in the streets. Inconsolably. And people were carrying coffins from their homes to a little mosque down the street. And there it was filled with coffins. There were 25 coffins, and we were told that that mosque was only for the bodies of women and children.
Today we go to Baghdad to speak with Mei Ying Welsh on a series of market bombings by the U.S. that have killed dozens of civilians. We go to Israel, where an Israeli journalist has just returned from being detained by the U.S. military in Iraq. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh will talk about Donald Rumsfeld ignoring the advice of his top generals on how to attack Iraq. And we'll hear from media critic Norman Solomon.
U.S. Central Command continues today to talk about Iraqi death squads, but the U.S. Command and the U.S. news media refuse to acknowledge that the most powerful death squads on the planet by far are being operated by the Pentagon.
All that and more coming up. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. troops shot and killed between 7 and 10 Iraqi civilians yesterday, including women and young children, at an intersection near Karbala. Officers from the Army's 3rd Infantry Division say a van packed with 15 civilians approached the intersection. The Washington Post reports Captain Ronnie Johnson repeatedly ordered his troops to fire warning shots. When they failed to take action, he yelled at them to stop the van. The troops responded by firing several high explosive rounds into the passenger cabin of the van. According to the Washington Post, 10 people, including women and 5 children who appeared to be under 5 years old, were killed on the spot. 26-year-old Army medic Sergeant Mario Manzano said, quote, "It was the most horrible thing I've ever seen, and I hope I never see it again." He said one of the wounded women sat in the vehicle holding the mangled bodies of 2 of her children. He said she didn't want to get out of the car. Hours later, U.S. Marines killed another Iraqi civilian at another roadblock. The Pentagon issued a statement contradicting the Washington Post's account. The Pentagon claims troops fired on the van after the driver ignored shouted orders and warning shots, and the Pentagon says 7, not 10 people were killed. The tragedy comes after 4 U.S. Marines were killed by a suicide bomber at a nearby checkpoint on Saturday. After the bombing, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Rutter told the New York Times that Iraqis who now approach the checkpoint have 5 seconds to turn around or, quote, they're dead. Civilians in Janabia, a village on the southeastern edge of Baghdad, say coalition forces bombed the town earlier this week, killing 20 people, including 11 children and 7 women. A journalist with the Agence France-Presse visited the area and reported bloodied school books and children's shoes lying amidst animal carcasses on the road. One of the 2 survivors from the house that was hit said, quote, "5 children were turned into human torches in this house because of the gas cylinders inside." A neighbor with missile debris in his hand said, quote, "That is Bush's democracy. They want us to welcome them with flowers. Look what they've done to our families." AFP journalists have eyewitnessed 5 incidents in which civilians were the primary victims of a coalition strike. They've reported at least 70 dead and dozens of wounded. In other incidents barely mentioned by the U.S. media, Mark Franchetti of the Sunday Times in Britain reported finding 12 dead civilians lying in the road or in nearby ditches in Nasiriyah. A girl aged no more than 5 lay dead in a ditch beside the body of a man who may have been her father. One man's body was still on fire. A father, baby girl, and boy had been buried in a shallow grave. Franchetti reported the civilians had been trying to leave the town, probably for fear of being killed by U.S. helicopter attacks or heavy artillery. He wrote, quote, "Their mistake had been to flee over a bridge that is crucial to the coalition supply lines and to run into a group of shell-shocked young American Marines with orders to shoot anything that moved." A surgical assistant at the Saddam Hospital in Nasiriyah told the London Guardian that U.S. aircraft had dropped 3 or 4 cluster bombs on civilian areas in the city, killing 10 and wounding 200 people. The Guardian also reports correspondents have seen more than a dozen burnt-out buses and trucks and the bodies of at least 60 Iraqi men on the road north of Nasiriyah. A British officer said U.S. Marines, who are escorting him through the port of Umm Qasr, let loose a volley of rifle fire at a house on the outskirts of town. He told Reuters they said they'd been shot at from the house a few days ago, so they were giving him a warning. The British officer said, quote, "That is something we would never condone." A U.S. Special Forces officer told Reuters, "It's sometimes difficult to contain the exuberance of men doing the actual fighting." Meanwhile, U.S. peace activists have provided the first confirmation that the hospital in the western town of Rutba has been destroyed by bombs. The Associated Press is reporting that as the Iraq peace team members approached, a doctor demanded, why did you Americans bomb our children's hospital? The activists say they saw no significant Iraqi military presence near the hospital or elsewhere in Rutba. U.S. Central Command claimed Sunday it had no knowledge of the incident. The first U.S. conscientious objector from the invasion will give himself up at a Marine base in California this morning. 20-year-old reservist Stephen Eagle Funk says he believes the war is, quote, immoral because of the deception involved by our leaders. Funk faces a possible court-martial and time in military prison for his action. U.S. soldiers preparing to march to Baghdad are fighting at close range with members of Iraq's Republican Guard for the first time. U.S. officers said 200 Iraqis had been killed, wounded, or captured in the first major battle against units of the elite Iraq Guard that broke out overnight southeast of Karbala, 50 miles from Baghdad. Meanwhile, the extremely intense bombing of Baghdad is continuing around the clock. The Agence France-Presse is reporting at least seven of Baghdad's telephone exchanges have been pounded in recent days, knocking out services in some areas and adding to the anguish of residents. Intense fighting is underway near the Tomb of Ali in the town of Najaf, where more than 1,000 Fedayeen fighters have been reportedly taken cover. The walled shrine marks the resting place of Prophet Muhammad's son-in-law and is one of the holiest sites for Shiite Muslims. One U.S. soldier was killed in the fighting, and U.S. warplanes bombed targets as close as half a mile from the shrine. The Iraqi information minister, Sayed al-Sahaf, says U.S. warplanes have bombed two buses carrying international volunteers, including some Americans. An anonymous senior official from the U.S. Central Command in Qatar told reporters yesterday the U.S. is prepared to pay a, quote, very high price in terms of casualties in order to capture Baghdad and oust Saddam Hussein. Referring to World War II, when U.S. forces lost 1,000 people some nights, he added, quote, there will come a time maybe when things are going to be much more shocking. Also yesterday in Doha, the Pentagon showed video of U.S. bombs destroying Iraqi aircraft as part of its daily briefing. But British military analyst Paul Beaver told the BBC that the Iraqi aircraft sitting out in the open on the runways look like useless decades-old decoys. The former publisher of Jane's Defense Weekly said he was surprised they would be shown on television. U.S. intelligence and military officials say they are scaling back a three-month effort to persuade Iraq's generals and Ba'ath Party leaders to surrender and oust Saddam Hussein after it failed to produce any significant defections. A senior intelligence official told USA Today, quote, we misjudge their tenacity. Meanwhile, the British newspaper The Daily Mirror has hired Pulitzer Prize-winning war correspondent Peter Arnett. Arnett was fired by NBC yesterday for telling the Iraqi state television the U.S. war plan had failed due to Iraqi resistance. Arnett told The Mirror, quote, I am still in shock and awe at being fired. He said, I report the truth of what's happening here in Baghdad and will not apologize for it. Arnett is one of the last correspondents left in Baghdad. The London Observer is reporting the retired U.S. general who will oversee humanitarian relief and reconstruction in post-war Iraq is also the president of an arms company that provides crucial technical support to missile systems vital to the U.S. invasion of the country. Jay Garner is president of Virginia-based Cy Coleman, a subsidiary of defense electronics group L3 Communications. L3 Communications provides technical services and advice on the Patriot missile system being used in Iraq. The issue is causing serious concerns at the United Nations and among aid agencies, who say appointment of an American link to the arms trade is the worst-case scenario for running the country after the war. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. That was Edwin Starr, War. And Jeremy Scahill joins us recently back from Baghdad. Jeremy.
Well, the headline that you just read about Garner, the person who reportedly has been pegged to take control of Iraq, there was an interesting piece in The Guardian of London today. It said a disagreement has broken out at a senior level within the Bush administration over a new government that the U.S. is secretly planning in Kuwait to rule Iraq in the immediate aftermath of the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Under the plan, the government will consist of 23 ministries, each of them headed by an American. Every ministry will also have four Iraqi advisors appointed by the Americans, The Guardian has learned. The government will take over Iraq city by city. Areas will be declared, quote, liberated by General Tommy Franks, and then they'll be transferred to the temporary government under the overall control of Jay Garner, who, as you just said, has very strong ties to the defense industry.
Well, we're going to go directly to Baghdad right now. We just reached Maying Welsh, independent reporter on the ground, and asked her to describe the latest news for us from the Iraqi capital.
We've had extremely intensive bombing over the last few days, and it's been going on 24 hours a day. Just last night, there were three huge explosions very nearby our hotel. They must have been using some kind of bunker-busting bombs, because these bomb blasts absolutely rocked the hotel that I'm in, even though they were relatively far away. The glass was trembling. They were very, very violent explosions, and they've been continuous. They've just been going on day and night.
Mei Ying, we're hearing reports also that the University of Baghdad was hit overnight, as well as one of Saddam Hussein's palaces and Iraq's Olympic headquarters. Talk about which sites you know have been hit in the last 24 hours.
Well, you know, I'm really not allowed to talk about what sites have been hit specifically. I only can really talk about sites that that we've been taken to see by the ministry officially. Today we were able to see the University of Baghdad. There was a huge crater next to the College of Women's Education. I mean, this obviously, if they were trying to hit a particular building at the university, I think they didn't know which one they were trying to hit, and even if they were trying to hit that one, they missed, because the crater was next to this building. All of the windows and glass was shattered on the floor. The blast was so powerful that it had warped blackboards and folded them in half. It was a site where there was no people, because there's no schools going on right now. I mean, there's no universities are open, no schools are open. No official government offices are open. I mean, everything's closed. So luckily, no one was there. No one was injured.
Mei Ying, can you tell us about the latest market bombing?
Well, there have been a number of civilian bombings over the weekend. We are hearing of 9 children killed in Hilla, but of course, I can't confirm that. We are pretty much confined to Baghdad. We haven't been able to leave yet. But the latest really big civilian bombing happened on Friday evening in a place called Shola in the far western end of Baghdad. It's a very, very poor neighborhood. And the market, 5:30, 6 o'clock at night, is when the market is at its absolutely highest point. That would be when there would be a maximum number of people doing their shopping for the evening, most of them being women, and especially on a Friday. So at that time, the market was absolutely packed. We talked to eyewitnesses. A lot of people said they saw the plane. Some people said they heard the plane, and then there was a huge explosion. We saw the crater. It was quite large, and it was right in front of this souk. It killed at least 50 people and injured, we still don't know how many. Whole families were killed in this blast. When we arrived on the scene on Friday night, just a few hours after it had happened, people were still crying and wailing in the streets. Inconsolably. And people were carrying coffins from their homes to a little mosque down the street. And there it was filled with coffins. There were 25 coffins, and we were told that that mosque was only for the bodies of women and children. And there were mostly men in the mosque, and some of them were sobbing and crying. Others of them were quiet and just had these looks on their faces that were just horrible. And, one person told me, he said, I'm going to have my revenge for this. He said, I'm going to be a human bomb, and I'm going to explode whatever Americans I can find, any U.S. forces I can find. I mean, some people were just really angry beyond control, and other people were very quiet and sad. And it was a very awesome and terrifying experience to be there as an American surrounded by all of these people. I mean, I would never have told anyone I was an American there, because I don't know what would have happened.
Also, Mei Ying, we reported yesterday on Democracy Now! On the killing of 7 Iraqi civilians yesterday at a roadblock outside of the city of Najaf. Today, General Peter Pace, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that the U.S. soldiers who shot these 7 civilians that were all Iraqi women and children, he said that the soldiers at that checkpoint, quote, did absolutely the right thing.
I mean, from the point of view of Iraqis here, they're really starting to feel under attack. And what's happening is there's a polarization going on where people are really starting to feel that, I mean, anyone who might have thought that the U.S. forces were here for their liberation, these people are having a change of heart because they are feeling under attack. I've talked to a number of people who've had that exact change of heart, who before were supportive of the idea, were open-minded to the idea, and who are now absolutely 100% against any U.S. forces coming here. I mean, you know, people are being affected everywhere. I mean, even Iraqi journalists who are working with us, you know, here at the hotel have told me that their houses were shelled or their house collapsed or all the windows were broken, that their wife is depressed and has gone off to another village because she can't handle this anymore. I mean, nobody is not being affected by this, and people feel that they are the ones who are being attacked. So it's really kind of, I mean, I'm seeing a change in people where they're starting to basically feel against the U.S. forces.
Mei Ying, actually, the front page of the Washington Post today is contradicting the Pentagon report and saying that 10 innocent people were killed. The Washington Post says as an unidentified four-wheel drive vehicle came barreling toward an intersection held by troops of the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, Captain Ronnie Johnson grew increasingly alarmed, and then he describes opening fire, and they say that they killed 10 people. It was on the intersection on Highway 9.
Right. I think that's probably the same incident that people are talking about here near Najaf. I mean, Karbala and Najaf are somewhat close to one another. All I can say is that, you know, I mean, Iraqis are really starting to feel that they are the ones who are being attacked, not necessarily the government. This can only be bad for the future of the war, since the whole idea of it was premised on winning the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. The exact opposite is happening.
Mei Ying, the Iraqi Information Minister Mohammed Saeed Al-Sahaf said today that several buses carrying volunteers, including international volunteers, including Americans, were bombed when they were entering Iraq. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I heard the Iraqi news agency was reporting that there were two buses containing foreigners in solidarity with Iraq. Some of them were Americans, and that they were fired on by U.S. forces, and some of them were killed. They were trying to enter the country to come here as human shields. And this happened in Anbar province to the west. I mean, you know, unfortunately, this information comes to us by very insecure methods. So it takes a while to get this stuff confirmed. And, you know, I mean, sometimes it never gets confirmed. And we still don't know how many injuries there were from Shola or what the final total on how many people killed were. You know, some people, you know, they just take their relatives home and they don't even get a death certificate for them. You know, they bury them as quickly as possible, according to Islamic tradition. Other people, you know, they take the casualty to the nearest hospital they can, and if that one's too crowded, take it to another one. These things happen in a very disorganized way, and you know, with everything centralized being bombed here, you know, all the government buildings, which would normally contain documents and have all kinds of bureaucratic workers to deal with all of these issues. I mean, at this point, everything is almost like hearsay.
We're also getting reports of people coming into Iraq to fight against the U.S. forces, the Allied forces, in a kind of holy war. Have you
right.
heard about this?
The Iraqis have announced it. They've said that at least 4,000 Arab volunteers are here and ready to fight. They've been interviewed on Iraqi television. One of them was an elderly man from Egypt who was here to fight the Americans. He was very old. Another one of them was from Syria, and he was a very religious man, and he was here for religious reasons because he sees this as a land upon which prophets walked, from where Abraham the prophet came. So, I mean, there's people coming here for different reasons. Some of them are Arab nationalist reasons. Some of them are religious reasons, you know, and I mean, they're putting aside the fact that this is historically or traditionally a secular government, and they're looking at it not as, you know, the government of the Ba'ath Party and President Saddam Hussein. They're looking at it as Iraq, an Islamic country in the Middle East, which is being invaded by Americans.
Mei Ying, over this last almost 2 weeks now of the U.S. invasion, how has the general atmosphere in Baghdad changed? What are people saying? What does the city look like?
Well, we have sunny weather, and it would be really nice for people to be out, except for that, you know, with the really heavy bombing that's been happening over the last couple of days, you don't see very many people on the streets, and there's not even that many cars out, not as much as there was before. You know, people are getting, you know, they're staying in their homes pretty much. We're not seeing a lot of people.
There's a discussion in this country about whether the U.S. misjudged the level of resistance of the Iraqi people. And I'm wondering if you're hearing about that, if you could also bring in the Peter Arnett firing by NBC and National Geographic and what you understand about that, how people are viewing it there because he went on Iraqi television.
Right. Well, I mean, here in Iraq, it's kind of an article of faith that that there is a lot of resistance for nationalist and patriotic reasons to the U.S. and British forces. I mean, it's not considered a subversive or anti-American thing to say here. It's just considered to be a fact. I mean, people here are very as I said before, they're becoming polarized. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who are not fans of this government or this president who are sitting here right now saying to themselves, there's no way I'm going to allow these people into my land. I mean, I've heard this from people. You know, they don't like the way the American soldiers are behaving. They don't like to see the invasions of the cities, the attempted invasions, I should say. I mean, these civilian bombings, which are everyone in Baghdad is aware of, even if they didn't see the footage on Iraqi television, they know people that it happened to, or they know people that live in neighborhoods where it happened to, or it happened in their neighborhood. So, I mean, people are really, you know, starting to feel very, very angry about the U.S. forces coming here, and that's creating a sense of resistance. I mean, you'll see on Iraqi television, you'll see these people singing chants for Saddam Hussein, and, you know, they have these kind of odes to him and poetry for him and things like that. And, you know, before this war, you know, I would have looked at it as, I don't know, propaganda or something like that. And, of course, it is propaganda. But, you know, now when I see it, I wonder sometimes if the people who are chanting these songs and reading this poetry, I wonder how much when they mention the name of President Saddam Hussein, I wonder how much that inside them they're not really actually thinking, you know, that President Saddam Hussein has become a symbol, so to speak, of Iraq. That talking about him is just a way of talking about Iraq, a way of talking about the country, and a way of sort of saying, you know, a way of being defiant, basically, because they know that the United States is the arch enemy of President Saddam Hussein. And so by praising him, it almost becomes a way of insulting the Americans.
And Peter, are nets firing?
Well, I mean, Peter, you know, he gave an interview to Iraqi television, and I believe in the beginning NBC stood by him. But when there was a lot of pressure from, you know, various from Republican Congress people and things like that, NBC caved. And, you know, Peter is feeling very much like the reason why he's getting ousted is because he did nothing more than say the truth. You know, the truth being that the Americans didn't expect this level of resistance from the Iraqis. They expected to sweep this place, and that hasn't happened. They still don't have a single city or town in Iraq, except for Qusr. So, you know, I think he feels, I spoke to him last night, and I think he feels that, you know, all he did was state a very obvious fact.
You know, it's interesting. It's interesting, Mei-Ying. I heard John Burns of the New York Times saying on CBS precisely the same thing, that he himself, John Burns, and the Pentagon had miscalculated the level of resistance.
Yeah.
But he said it on American TV.
This has really gone from being sort of a I don't know, a campaign to protect one individual, President Saddam Hussein, to being a campaign to sort of protect the country from foreign occupation. And that really, you know, that really cuts to the heart of the way a lot of people feel, regardless of how they feel about the government. I mean, I think it's a form of Iraqi patriotism that we're seeing coming out. And, you know, if anybody has studied the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted 8 years from 1980 to 1988, they would notice that the very population that was supposed to rise up against this government and help the American forces, namely the Shias of southern Iraq, they were loyal to this government for 8 years during that war, and they fiercely fought their Iranian Shia brothers. So, you know, and why was that? You know, I mean, we have to ask the question, I mean, to what extent did they feel Arab and not Persian? To what extent did they feel Iraqi and not Iranian? You know what I mean? To what extent did they feel that there is an Iraqi national identity for themselves, you know, and that no foreign invader should be able to come in and take over their land? If that war had been studied a little bit more closely, perhaps we would have a better understanding of how this war is going.
And finally, Mei-Ying, last week you reported on Democracy Now! About how leaflets were being distributed in neighborhoods around Baghdad and elsewhere with pictures of significant religious figures in Iraq, with a reiteration of the religious decrees that had been issued calling on people to fight and not participate or cooperate with any invasion of the country. What other signs are you seeing now that there are preparations for the attempted invasion of Baghdad?
Well, you know, I haven't seen any change in the level of preparation, to be honest with you. It's looked pretty much the same for the past 2 weeks now. You know, I don't see, you know, I don't know, giant trucks being moved here or there, or, you know, an additional number of soldiers. I'm not seeing a lot of extra preparations. Things pretty much look exactly the same as they did before. You know, it's really interesting because there were seven Italian journalists who were picked up in Basra. They were arrested by the Iraqi government. They were picked up on Friday. They had originally gone to Basra because they'd been told by U.S. forces in Doha that the U.S. controlled Basra. So they went to Basra to go and try and cover the story, only to get there and realize that all the U.S. forces controlled was the perimeter of the city, but that they didn't control the city itself. And they said that only 500 yards from a U.S. checkpoint, there were Ba'ath Party militia kind of sitting in front of a gas station, lazily smoking cigarettes, waiting for their opportunity to, you know, actually have a battle, that there were traffic cops in the streets. I mean, that the whole city was completely under the control of the Iraqi authorities.
Well, Mei Ying, thank you very much for taking this time to talk to us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Mei Ying Welsh reporting to us from Baghdad, Iraq. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch. Stay with us.
You loved your sweet country for all of your life, like your mother and father before you. And the land runs deep, so deep in your blood, your flesh and your bone and your sinews. Descendants and ancestors deep as it goes, a relative circle as far as your eye. It can all be undone in the flash of an instant, mechanical thunder that bruises the sky, bruises the sky. Goodbye to my relatives all of my life, never again will I see. You won't have a name when they fly the big airplanes. Collateral damage is all you will be, all you will be.
Jim Page, Collateral Damage, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Jeremy Scahill. And we want to welcome Houston Media Source to the expanded two-hour program, broadcasting Texas time 7 to 9 every morning, as well as all the other stations around the country, Public Access TV, Pacifica Radio, NPR stations, and Pacifica affiliates, in this largest public media collaboration in the country. The New York Times today says long simmering tensions between Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Army commanders have erupted in a series of complaints from officers on the Iraqi battlefield that the Pentagon has not sent enough troops to wage the war as they want to fight it. Raw nerves were obvious as officers compared Rumsfeld to Robert McNamara, an architect of the Vietnam War who failed to grasp the political and military realities of Vietnam. One colonel who spoke on condition that his name be withheld was among the officers criticizing decisions to limit initial deployments of troops to the region. He wanted to fight this war on the cheap, the colonel said. He got what he wanted. Well, a major story in this week's New Yorker by Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hirsch has broke open this major rift. Can you talk more about it? Seymour Hirsch, welcome.
Oh, well, sure, yeah. You know, well, the Times story actually said, you know, said a lot today, as you just read. It's essentially what I wrote in the New Yorker this week, and I was simply the same story.
And tell us what that story is, what Rumsfeld's role in the whole shaping of the military that's in Iraq right now, who went, who didn't, what weapons were sent, what strategy would be used.
Basically what happened, the thing I did that was different, there's been a lot of mumbling. Some of the retired generals and the talkers you see on television, there's been some rumbling about, you know, problems in the war. What I did was get some of the people involved in the actual, who actually did the war plan. I'm talking about young officers, sometimes majors, lieutenant colonels, colonels. They work in something known as the Joint Staff. They work for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's a separate unit in the Pentagon. All of the services work together, and they're the ones who do the war plan. And those people, over the last 6 or 8 months, have been working on a war plan. And the military is a terribly inefficient place. And as one general said to me just the other week, he said, you know, we don't believe in fighting fair. We want to overload the battlefield. And so they devised a plan that had the approval of the chairman, General Myers, and Tommy Franks, the chief commander, the head of CENTCOM of the war out there. And the first, they began to present plans to Rumsfeld, who is Secretary of Defense, has a right to review them, certainly. And Rumsfeld insisted, the basic thing he did was insisted that the forces they were recommending were way too high. And what I wrote was, on six specific formal occasions, he ordered them to redo it. And actually, it's funny, the press sometimes doesn't hear what it hears. Over the weekend, my story came out over the weekend, and there was, on the Sunday morning talk shows, there was a lot of back and forth, and the General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, kept on saying, well, it was an iterative plan, which meant that they kept on, you know, the same plan, repeated again and again. Nobody got it. He was trying to give them a high sign. The fact is that it was a very serious breach because the planners anticipated that there could be a lot of opposition, that Iraq's had 12 years to rebuild. Not that it's stronger necessarily, but it's certainly, there's no reason to expect that it wasn't going to fight much better and much more intelligently than the first time around. And certainly Saddam has the capability, you know, he didn't stay in power as long as he did by being anything other than ruthless and cunning, and with emphasis on cunning, and they knew it could be very hard. But Rumsfeld, and I can't tell you what's in his mind, you know, but basically what he was following was this neoconservative point of view, which was that once we actually went to war, why, everybody would say, Mama, I give up, and we would sweep into Baghdad and overthrow the regime, and you know, and it would be like arriving in Paris, and you know, in at the end of World War II, they'd greet us with flowers and kisses.
By saying it's Rumsfeld, does it take responsibility from Bush?
You know, you just have to go piece by piece. We're talking about Rumsfeld in this article. I'm not done reporting.
Seymour Hersh, you clearly are not done. You're coming out with one piece after another that is taking many people down. But before...
Oh, that's terrific.
but let me ask you about the piece, Who Lied to Whom? Why did the administration endorse a forgery about Iraq's nuclear program? Can you quickly touch on that?
Yeah, well, you're talking about... frankly, of all the pieces I've done, this is the most important one, really, in the long run, I think, because what I wrote about was the fact that a few weeks before the Senate voted on the war resolution that gave the president the authority to do what he's doing, they were given some top-secret briefings by George Tenet, the head of the CIA, and Colin Powell, the director of state, head of the State Department, Secretary of State, and one of the elements they used to convince the senators that Iraq is really lethal was, and perhaps much more involved in nuclear planning than we wanted to believe, was a report, an intelligence report that they received from Britain, British intelligence, indicating that Saddam had purchased 500 tons of uranium oxide, yellow cake they call it, which is a necessary ingredient to run a nuclear reactor, and also with some further work can be used to produce weapons-grade fissile material. So that was a chilling sort of fact that would remain secret, and it turned out that it was a total fraud. The papers were fraud. They were very bad frauds. And when the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, it has a special team that investigates such issues. Their action team, as it was once called, it's got a different name now, looked at it, and with a few hours of looking at the original documents and going on Google, they disproved them totally. They were complete falsifications and not very good ones. So the question remains, how did this information get to the Senate? How did it end up later in the State of the Union address? And also, as I wrote, it was also in the president's daily brief, which is the most, you know, the CIA prepares a highly classified 2 or 3 page summary of the world events every morning for the president when he gets to his office. It is sacrosanct. Very few people in the government see it. And so how did it get to all those places if it was as bad a document as you make? And that's, I just posed all those questions in that article.
And what about Richard Perle? You're beyond that in your pieces, but he has just resigned from his unpaid chairmanship of the influential Pentagon Advisory Board, the Defense Policy Board, but will stay as a member, a key national security team member of George Bush. In yesterday's Wall Street Journal, he refers to you because you're the one who first exposed his conflicts of interest. If you could briefly say them, he says the New Yorker piece by Seymour Hersh is a masterpiece of falsehood and innuendo. Why do you think Pearl should leave the board?
Well, he did leave the, you know, I mean, leave, I mean, stop being, be more than just, not just chairman. I think, you know, I think eventually he probably will, the pressure will mount. I can't imagine he can stay on the board. I mean, it doesn't seem to solve the problem.
Can you explain what that problem is?
In a short word, greed and conflict of interest. And, it seems clear that there's evidence that he certainly, I'll make the case for him and say he may not know there's a conflict. He may not in his own mind think there's a conflict, but anybody else, you know, I'll give him his due. I sort of like Richard because he's one of those people who does talk. You know, a lot of what we know about the policy of this government, he's been telling us for a year and a half or 2 years and actually much longer. But we weren't listening, were we? And anyway, simply put, he's under the conflicts of issue laws or that we have, the code of conduct, even for somebody like Pearl, who's not on a he's on a volunteer board, but it's a board with a lot of influence. You can't do anything, use your office in any way that furthers your economic interests, and you have to also be very sensitive to the appearance of a conflict, because that also can jeopardize the integrity of the board or the people you serve with. And that's his problem. I can't, you know, at this point, there's other fish to fry, but I can't imagine he'll be allowed to stay on the board either. I think eventually that'll have to happen. He'll have to leave that, too.
Seymour Hersh, I wanted to ask very quickly about Barry McCaffrey, who's on NBC and MSNBC. People may remember the piece that you did on Barry McCaffrey and his role in the Persian Gulf War when you alleged that units of the 24th Infantry Division under McCaffrey's command fired into a group of unarmed Iraqi prisoners in the waning days of the war. We see him every day commenting on what should be happening now. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, it wasn't so much what I allege. It's what I quoted an awful lot of people who work for McCaffrey. It was quite a horrible thing he did. The war, there's a ceasefire, and the enemy, one of the Republican Guard units was given a path by our third, by the people who negotiated a ceasefire. They negotiated a path to go home. And they were going home with their, you know, whatever, however tanks are, move in such a way that their cannons are not usable, and they're clearly, the guys are, the soldiers are sunbathing, and McCaffrey hit them early in the morning. His troops claimed they had been struck first, which is a fallacious story. Look, Barry McCaffrey, he's very smart. He's now saying a lot of what I, you know, in the last couple of days, he's gotten much more outspoken. He's all over the New York Times today saying, oh my God, this is horrible. I'll tell you one thing, until 5 days before that war began, he, inside that network, he was telling everybody the war would be over in a few days. So there we are. And that's McCaffrey. He's smart, though. He's what he is.
And you know, last point I wanted to raise with you, it's one you raised at the end of our discussion last time, but we didn't get to the end of it. It has to do with compliance of the press, and we had referred back to the Bush press conference where Helen Thomas was relegated to I don't know what row. She did not open the news conference, and she was not called on for the first time in a long time. And you talked about Dana Milbank's The Washington Post. You didn't get a chance to say what you said off the air was what you think reporters should do in these cases when reporters who ask tough questions get iced out.
Well, you know, I'm not wildly interested in self-immolation, so I don't like to, you know, I'll just let my work stand for where I think about the press corps. I don't like to, I'll just tell you what you want me to say, which is that if I'd been there, I think I would have, if I'd been given a question, I think it would have been very simple that for one of the reporters to stand up and say, thank you, Mr. President, but I want to give my question to Dana Milbank. I think that would have, within 10 seconds, it would have restored some dignity to the press corps and let the world see what was happening. But none of them did it. And maybe I'm Pollyanna. Maybe that wouldn't have happened. But I have to tell you, I did things like that when I covered the Pentagon for the Associated Press 35 years ago, 30 years ago, that long ago, my God. We have every right. We have every right as journalists to stand up for ourselves as anybody, whether he's got 4 stars or he's a president. We all have the same standing in this country, and we should remember that more. That's all.
Well, Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you for being with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter.
No problem.
Writing for The New Yorker. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Israel. An Israeli journalist was detained by the U.S. military. I'll talk about the experience, and then we'll be joined by Norman Solomon, media critic. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. As we go now to Israel, the International Press Watch Group, Reporters Without Borders, has accused the U.S. and British coalition forces in Iraq of displaying contempt for journalists covering the conflict who are not embedded with troops. The criticism comes after a group of 4, quote, unilateral or roving reporters revealed how they were arrested by U.S. military police as they slept near a U.S. unit 100 miles south of Baghdad and held overnight. They described their ordeal is the worst 48 hours of their lives. The 4 journalists, Israeli journalist Dan Samama, Boaz Bismuth, and Portuguese Luis Castro and Victor Silva, entered Iraq in a jeep and followed a U.S. convoy but were not officially attached to the troops. U.S. military police seized the journalists outside their base, detained them even though they were carrying international press cards. The group claims they were mistreated and denied contact with their families. We're joined now by Dan Samama in Israel. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, good afternoon.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe exactly what happened?
Yes, we went into Iraq to report about the war. We went on a jeep that we had, that we have rented. We were 4 guys. We all had credentials that we got from the American Army. It's true, on the credential it's written unilateral, and it was not written embedded. We just went in. And we saw the British crews fighting. We saw the American soldiers fighting. We spent our nights with the American and the British soldiers, each time in another camp, in another place where they were parked. We were with them. We got to a place that was about 120 kilometers south, which is, I think, 70 maybe miles south of Baghdad. And there we met a group of the army of soldiers, and there was there also Ted Koppel was there with uniforms, with a big helmet on his head. And Ted Koppel looked at me and said to me, "You're crazy. You don't have a gas mask. Are you crazy? Because they're going to use your chemical weapons." And I did not recognize Ted Koppel, of course, but then I found out that it was him. And then we were asked by the army there to try and get a gas mask, because if not, it's very dangerous for our life. So we went south a little bit. We met another American troop, a chemical officer we met. We asked him for a gas mask, and he gave it to us as a gift, which what I'm trying to tell you is we met a lot of American soldiers and a lot of beautiful people that helped us, that understood what we're doing there, and that a lot of times were trying to help us as much as they could, until we got to this one group of soldiers, in which the head of them was a guy that called himself, he did not call himself, we succeeded to find out his name, because he did not want to identify himself, and his name was First Lieutenant Cho, which I will never forget his name. And him, with his soldiers, has decided that we are very dangerous spies for Iraq. They decided that the CD player that we had is an electronic device that we use to tell the Iraqis where the American soldiers are. They took away our cameras. They took away our ID cards. They took our money. They took our phones. They put their guns towards us. They forced us to lie down on the floor, to take our shirts up to make sure that we don't have an explosive on our body. They checked us, our bodies. They checked our car. I'm afraid I'm too long, so maybe you have another question, and then I'll continue.
Was one of the Portuguese reporters beaten up?
Yes. After we were arrested at 6 o'clock in the morning by these guys, and at about 11:30, I think it was, which is some 5.5 hours after we were arrested, he kind of lost his patience, the Portuguese guy, and they put us in our jeep, they closed us inside the jeep, and they said we are not allowed to get out of the jeep, and we are supposed to stay there. And so the Portuguese guy went out of the jeep, approached the armies, the camp, the soldiers, and said, please, please, I am begging you. I have a wife, I have children. Let me just give a call, make a telephone call to tell them that we are safe, that we are with you Americans and not with the Iraqis. They might think at home that we are killed by Iraqis. Please just let us tell them that. And they said to him, go immediately to your car. And he said, please, I am begging you. 5 soldiers went out of the camp, jumped on him, started to beat him and to kick him. We ran to his direction. They all put bullets inside the cannons of their guns, and they said that if we move forward, they shoot at us. We were standing like stupid guys. We saw our friend lying on the ground crying, hurting. They tied his hand behind his back. They took him into the camp, and after half an hour, they let him go, and he came back to us all crying. And then came this Lieutenant Cho, and he told us, don't mess with my soldiers. Don't mess with them because they are trained like dogs to kill, and they will kill you if you try again.
Well, Dan Simama, how long were you ultimately held by the U.S. forces?
We were there in our jeep for 36 hours outside the camp. They asked us if we need anything. They came politely, very nice. Lieutenant Cho, he came again. Do you need anything? And we said, yes, if we can get a little food. And he said, I don't have enough food for my soldiers. I will not give you food. Hmm. After about an hour, we saw a soldier going with water, a bottle of water, to our direction. And we said, look, something human is happening here. Somebody is coming to us with water. And then we saw that he gave the water to a dog that was there, not to us.
Well.
And they kept us 36 hours, and after 36 hours, they put us on an helicopter and sent us to Kuwait. And we thought, okay, now we are safe. And in the military camp, American military camp in Kuwait, they hold us in a tent, standing up for 6 hours. An officer was standing next to us. I don't remember his name. One of the sergeants that was there said, do you want a cup of coffee? And the officer shouted at him, don't give them anything. Don't tell them anything. Don't talk to them. Don't be nice to them. And he said to us, don't move and don't talk to each other. This was already after 40-something hours that we were there. And suddenly at 6 o'clock in the morning, that was exactly 48 hours from the moment we were caught, everything started. They said, guys, everything is finished. Everything is finished. What hotel are you staying here in Kuwait City? We'll take you to your hotel. Listen, what we did, we asked, can we use our mobile phone, our satellite phone? And they said, yes. And we all four of us took the satellite phone that we had there. We called home. We all four of us started to cry. And the sergeant that 6 hours before wanted to give us a cup of coffee came to us, a sergeant major of the American Army. And he started to hug us. He was crying. And he said, believe me, it's not all the American Army. Excuse me. I love you. I am with you. Excuse us, please and please and please. This story was finished. They took me to my hotel. And when I arrived to my hotel, 5 minutes later, I had time to take a shower. I wanted to eat something because I did not eat for a long time. And 5 minutes after I finished my shower, people knocked on my door in my hotel. And it was Kuwaiti secret police. And they told me, for your own safety, we have to throw you out of Kuwait immediately. And they took me to the airport and threw me out of Kuwait. I'm sure the American did that.
Well, Dan Samama, I want to thank you for recounting what happened to you and your colleagues, another Israeli journalist and two Portuguese journalists, and get final comment from our guest in the studio, Norman Solomon, who has been following the treatment of reporters, the embedded and the unembedded, like Dan Samama, Norman Solomon.
Yeah, those who are not in bed with the military get rough treatment. Those who are reciprocate the good treatment. For instance, night before last on CNN, Walter Rogers. This is how grotesque the pseudo-journalism on cable networks has become. Walter Rogers, a CNN correspondent with U.S. troops in Iraq, being interviewed by former U.S. General Wesley Clark, now on CNN payroll back in the United States. General Clark asked the correspondent a question. The CNN correspondent replies, quote, "No, sir, General," unquote. I think that's kind of a metaphor for the kind of coverage we're getting. You know, something I think we need to very much keep in mind as people concerned, angry, upset about this outrageous war is that media framing is a very powerful form of propaganda. And the way that debates are even put forward, the limits and surrounding parameters of what is even talked about, really is a very powerful form of propagandizing. So we need to ask ourselves, what is the most important critique of the war makers? It's not whether there should have been more troops sent in earlier. It's not whether Rumsfeld miscalculated. What is the remedy that's being proposed? What is the hindsight critique being put forward by the mass media? It's implicitly, well, gee, they should have sent in more troops. We need, obviously, a very different critique of this war. They didn't need more troops. They needed to not send troops in the first place.
I want to ask you, Norman, if you, one, would be able to join us again tomorrow, because we haven't had the time that we need with you today.
Sure.
But if you would comment on Peter Arnett's firing by NBC for doing an interview with Iraqi television where he talked about the failure of the U.S. war plan and the, at least at that point, the Iraqi resistance.
Yeah, well, Peter Arnett may have been too willing to praise his Iraqi hosts, but the fact is we have many, many journalists who are sycophants to the U.S. government. They get praised. They get called wonderful journalists and reporters. It's Peter Arnett's unwillingness, ultimately, to parrot the line of the Pentagon that has caused NBC, which after all is owned by General Electric, a major military contractor, to pull the plug on him. And it's emblematic of the fact that the U.S. mass media, on the whole, with very rare exceptions, does not want journalists. They want stenographers for the words coming out of Doha, out of Washington, and out of Central Command.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. Norman Solomon is author with Reese Ehrlich of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. It's published by Context Books. Tomorrow, we'll be looking also at the affirmative action case being argued by the U.S. Supreme Court. Thousands of students from Michigan, from Howard, and other places are outside the U.S. Supreme Court right now protesting on behalf of affirmative action. And that does it for today's show. If you want to get a video cassette copy or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, help today from Noah Reibel and Jenny. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Jeremy Scahill. Thanks for listening.